Welcome to the Davenport Cleaners Halftime Show on KSCJ. Here's your host, Brian Vakalskis.
My guests are a husband and wife duo, the American tenor John Osborne and Bolivian-American soprano Lynette Tapia, who will both be appearing with the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra on April 25th. John grew up in Sioux City. Lynette is a native Californian where the couple make their permanent home when they aren't on the road. John, this is an amazing thing to have you coming back to the Sioux City Symphony a second time here in the last 4 years. But I remember back when we were in high school, you were singing solos, and you clearly stood out among anybody else, and you've turned that talent into a career. But opera is not something that's mainstream in the United States, and it's virtually non-existent in Sioux City. So when did it enter your mind that you could channel those vocal talents into that direction?
That is such a great question. I think I was 16 years old, and I actually saw my first opera on Iowa Public Television, and it was The Barber of Seville being broadcast from, Simpson College. It was the Pope Theater, Blank Performing Arts Center, Simpson College, Indianola, Iowa. And when I was a junior in high school, I didn't know anything about opera, and I actually... That was the year that I became a soloist at the Iowa Allstate Music Festival. And a girlfriend of mine at the time said, you should totally go into opera. And I was like, opera? You know, I knew nothing about opera. I grew up not even going to the symphony. We would occasionally catch one of those concerts in the park, you know, what do you call the park? Right in the middle of town. Is it the
Grandview Park?
Yeah, Grandview Park, and so I would go see concerts occasionally with some friends, and actually it was more a friend of mine, his parents were more into symphonies and the arts, and so it was their idea. So, you know, we gathered two or three of our families, and we all went and sat out on the lawn and watched the symphony concerts, and I loved it. I still didn't know exactly what was going on there because I sang in school, but I had no like real education in music, like theory and stuff like that. So I didn't understand a lot. I had been taking trumpet lessons in junior high and then continued playing a little bit into high school. But then, I music was always part of my life. I always sang in church, probably from the time I was like 12 or 13. So, actually leading the masses and stuff like that. So, I just kind of learned on the sly and was learning how to sight read and stuff like that, just kind of without really knowing that I was actually doing that. So, yeah, I was 16 years old, didn't know anything about opera, but then I just was planted this little seed that I should go into opera, and then I just looked into it a little bit more, and I'll never forget that performance of Barbara Seville, and I just thought for the first time in my life, oh, opera was something other than, you know, horned helmets and breastplates and singing Hayotaho with a big staff, and that it looked like opera could actually be fun. So I took a chance, and here I am, quarter of a century later, dude.
Well, and Lynette, bringing you into this, you grew up in a much more diverse state of California. Was opera a thing out there as you grew up?
No, not really. We're king of Hollywood, pop, rock and roll. I was a gymnast. I loved my hard rock. I still do. But I was the Lone Ranger at age. I was different than John. I was a gymnast, and then my dad said, "Oh, she can sing," and he found a teacher in the Yellow Pages who actually was an opera singer. And well, I didn't know. Opera for me was like gymnastics for my voice, and I thought it was fun. And I did play piano like every kid, you know, took piano lessons. And so she kind of got me hooked, and I was so lucky. She introduced me to the world of opera, and then I just kind of fell into it. And a lot of people in San Clemente at the time where I was going to school and where I lived, there was one opera singer that he was a retired opera singer who kind of took me under his wing. He was in his mid-70s, and I just became very passionate about it. But everyone thought I was, you know, some weird kid that's into opera, you know, at the age of 15. And I won a slew of competitions in California, and the competitions were mainly against college people, and I would win, which I thought was strange. And I would go to Los Angeles, which was actually quite a drive from San Clemente, like an hour and a half, with good traffic, would be my drive. And I, at the age of 16, I did major competitions there, and the adjudicators were some huge opera singers that I didn't even know. And now when I discovered who they were, I was like, I was singing for legends. And it was really amazing. But I was very lucky to meet people who loved opera that knew so much about it and just guided me in the right way. So that's kind of how I got into it. I was the Lone Ranger in opera, but I did, of course, choir like everybody else, and I had a phenomenal choir. I don't know what we had in our water at my school, but we have quite a bit of talent at my school. Lots of Ryan Johnson, who is, he directs the Star Wars movies and stuff, and Knives Out, that he wrote that. He went to my same graduating class, and colleague of mine, Jorge Garcia. He's a dear friend of mine. He's a big actor. All my choir friends, and drama friends actually amounted to quite a lot. So there's a lot of people in the industry from my school. And I'm like, what was in our water? I don't know.
Well, so. John, most of the time you're identified as with the bel canto repertoire. That's a word that I did not know. What is that?
Bel canto is an Italian term. It literally means beautiful singing. And it is basically based on an old Italian style of technique and singing, which focuses on legato, which is, smooth, even singing and long, beautiful phrases and just singing as beautifully as you can. And so the repertoire, the three bel canto composers are considered Donizetti, Bellini, and Rossini. And those are three composers that I've sung a lot of throughout my career. I also sang quite a bit of Mozart. I moved into some light Verdi. And, the last 10, 13 years, actually, I can say I've been doing a lot of French opera, French grand opera. And I think that all is because of my bel canto background and my ability to always sing beautifully, sing healthily, and never drive the voice to the point of breakage, things like that. So I just stick to my guns and make sure that it's always beautiful, and hopefully I never am in a situation where I have to feel like I have to push or do something that could damage my voice. So I've maintained great vocal health over the years. Lynette has been helping me a lot in the last 10 years since we did have the same teacher, and she knows me better than anyone, and that's why even before this interview I actually told you that Lynette is with me half the time, and because we have our daughter that's going to school in Laguna Beach. She's an animation major there in Laguna, and that's pretty close to our house, and Lynette splits her time, half like a month here and a month home, a month here and a month home. Whereas I could be sometimes over here anywhere from 3 to 6 months. So, bououncing around Europe or in and out of, I've been as far as China and Japan as well. And, I've had a lot of great experiences doing all this, but it's, you need balance in your life, and Lynette has been highly instrumental in helping that balance happen.
And when you say over here, this morning as we talk, you're in Geneva, Switzerland, but some issues are coming up with international news as far as it may affect your performances over there, right?
Yeah, just I think a week ago they were already talking about how there were closures of like La Scala and Parma, and they even closed down the Carnival in Venice. So now it's leaking over to Switzerland, and they even just today, we had our opening just a couple days ago of the Huguenot. The Huguenots is another French grand opera, go figure. But now they're already threatening a canceling this evening's performance, and following the performances, they're saying that any event that is going to have more than 1,000 people is going to be illegal or not allowed. So we're trying to figure out if that is applicable to the opera if there are less than 1,000 people or less than 1,000 seats sold. You know, or I don't know, they're seriously trying to figure out maybe a loophole. Maybe if we have less than 1,000 people gathered, maybe we can still give all the performances. So I don't know if that's going to be, they're going to, they've already closed the box office. So they're not selling more tickets. They may ask some people to, they may refund some people their tickets just so we can still get performances. So this is like crazy. And I'm also thinking about the financial repercussions of this, because if I lose out on, you know, my next 4 performance fees, that could be pretty devastating for me in the next 6 months. So it's a real thing. And I'm not exactly sure how real this threat of the coronavirus is, how much of a threat it is. You know, you think about all the other ailments out there, all the other flus and colds and people dying of pneumonia every day. You know, I don't know how this is any different than what people are dying from and other things, including cancer and things like that. So we could also say that cancer is an epidemic, but it's not keeping us from going to work. It's also not contagious, so good point, Lynette. But, you know, I know that an illness is very serious. You know, it's all real, and it's affecting, you know, so many people. Not just businesses, but now you're seeing arts organizations. And so I'm just hoping and praying that the rest of this year gets ironed out and we can figure out a way to handle this so that it's not such a travesty for the entire planet.
How long does a typical run for an opera last when you're in a particular location?
I would say that the entire period is normally 6 to 8 weeks. So we usually, a new production will usually rehearse anywhere from 3.5 to 5.5 weeks, something like that. And then you have about 2 weeks of run of shows, like every other day or every third day. It depends on the opera house. A lot of opera houses have repertoire. So you're playing 3 or 4 operas a week, and so you're able to spread the performances out even longer. So of course, the more performances are spread out, the longer you have to pay for your hotel or apartment, things like that. So costs start getting higher, but hopefully hopefully you're compensated well enough that the sacrifices that you make in order just to be in a place is all well compensated. So.
When you go to these different locations and perform, you've got them scheduled ways in advance, but I even see this in Sioux City. The Symphony Orchestra will do a show for children. Do you have interaction with young kids trying to get them interested in opera when you're in these locations?
Well, you know, I find that, you know, music education for opera, you know, we're always thinking we need to educate the audience of tomorrow. I think I find it less and less in Europe because, I don't know, I think they're just holding on to their, no offense to anyone, but they're holding on to sort of their older fan base, and they're counting on that to, I don't know, somehow rub off on other people. A lot of people discovered the arts later in life. Like, maybe they didn't appreciate it when they were younger or didn't know anything about it when they were younger.
But in Europe, I would say, it's part of their culture. They all know opera exists. They all actually are quite introduced to that throughout their entire life. And the price of a ticket here to go to the opera is the same as going to a movie. So, of course, you can get better seats, but you can get a very good seat for the same price of a movie. So some kids, depending on what country you're in, like, I remember I was in Germany, and they were talking, should we go to the play, should we go to the opera, should we go to the movies? We don't have that kind of talk in the U.S., and I wish we did, but, you know, people put opera, I think, in the States as, oh, it's so expensive, when actually it's cheaper to go to the opera than the rock concert.
Oh, way cheaper than going to a rock concert, so.
So I'm always like, you pay how much for a ticket, and you guys think opera's expensive? I don't think so. But it's not part of our culture, and I think school districts in certain areas of the States are impressing the, you know, you have to play an instrument, you know, at fourth grade. You know, that would be way too late if you really wanted to be good to start playing the instrument. But at least they're introducing it. And so I know I did a lot of outreach in the beginning of my career, but it's hard to get people to go do outreach. I still like to do it as much as I can. because I think it's important, and you have to show people that actually opera is quite accessible. It's not from the other world. If you like musical theater, you're going to like opera. It's just, you know,
it's in a foreign language, basically.
But not always. We have American opera, too, but, you know, but it's very funny. The people who go to an American opera as opposed to an Italian opera, or they go, oh, I like the Italian better. I'm like, okay, and it was foreign, and you enjoyed it. So I think
granted, technology is helping a lot with the super titles being projected above the stage, stuff like that. We just had a wonderful meeting with Ryan Haskins yesterday, and he did inform us that the concert will have titles. So we are very excited about that, because that makes it just so much more enjoyable. People can see what we're actually singing and saying in English. I guess it'll just be translated into English. But we're excited about that. So technology is helping with education for, you know, to help some of those people that... Are you still there, Brian?
Oh, I am.
Okay. Hadn't heard from you. Haven't let you get a breath in lately. So, but the accessibility is there now that wasn't there like 50 years ago, as far as the insecurity with foreign languages and stuff like that. But even so, I think it's great to be exposed to foreign languages so that you can just hear what those sounds are like. And before you know it, you're picking up on words that you recognize, and then you're like, oh, at least, you know, when somebody's singing about l'amor or un bacio, you know, something like that. L'amore is like love, and bacio is like a kiss. So that's Italian. But also, you know, as far as education goes with the young people, the other issue that I wanted to bring up is that so many productions in Europe are quite perverse, and so actually a lot of places don't even allow children under the age of 12 to even like enter the theater.
Well, some of them, I'm glad they do, because they don't want to expose.
However, you know, even most of my friends today, or I would say my fans/friends, like Italians, French people, they all were exposed to it when they were very young. And of course, they were seeing classical, beautiful productions. And most of them are quite traditionalists, and they can't stand a lot of these modern productions that pervert the story, change the story, confuse the story.
Or has nothing to do with the story.
Or has absolutely nothing to do with the story. So, I mean, still opera is just another way of telling a story. But you have music, you have the orchestra, you have singers, you have the chorus, you have beautiful costumes, you have sets. All these are things that help identify the story, the time. You know, what did we start a story with? Once upon a time in a land far away, or you describe that place, and that's how you tell a story. And if a place is indescribable when you watch something, you don't understand anything that's going on, then it's, I don't know, it's a little bit counterproductive. So in educating people, it's really difficult when you're educating them of something that I hate to say, but of what opera is not. So I love to present it like, so we're giving a concert, we're giving a gala concert with selections from opera. So we're not performing an opera, we are performing numbers from an opera, and we will do our best to present, but in fancy tuxedo and gown, not necessarily, we're not going to be able to tell the story with our costumes, and there's no set. So, you know, it's...
But we can still tell the story.
But we're still using our communicative skills, our talents with languages to communicate, and thank goodness we're going to have these titles, so we're very cool, very happy about it.
I'm chatting with John Osborne and Lynette Tapia. They will be in Sioux City April 25th with the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra to perform several selections of the from different operas. And as I think about this whole idea with singing opera, you're overseas a lot. Could you make a living as an opera singer in the United States, or would you starve?
I mean, there are several opera singers making a living, working only in the United States. I'm not exactly sure all the reasons why that is, but, you know, if you find yourself being a regular in Chicago, New York, L.A., San Francisco, Houston, you know, you hit all these, you know, these big companies. If you find a career singing in A houses all the time, then, yeah, you're probably doing pretty well. And,
It's not easy, that I will say, that to have a career just as an American in America, or anyone just in America. It's opera is quite international. There's not as much opera in the States, but there is plenty of it. But to land positions in those houses are that's difficult. It's possible, but it's difficult.
I think it's not. Yeah, I don't want to say that it's completely realistic or unrealistic.
No.
It certainly depends on the level of talent, and a lot of it just depends on who the business decides to be, you know, one of the top artists, and then you get this publicity going, and if you have publicity, it's amazing what can happen. Even for sometimes who we might feel somebody is maybe less talented than others, we might feel are more deserving. We see it happening. We see it happening, and it's definitely possible.
I would never say it's about complete talent. Sometimes it's about you landed in the right place at the right time, and somebody said, we really like that person. It could be just that. And of course, it takes talent, you know, to maintain that. But, you know, just like in every industry, sometimes you're like, how come that person works and this person doesn't? Well, you don't know. So.
and you know, I really try to always perform on a very high level. And so each performance I prepare as though it's like it has to be like my last great performance. And so to maintain this level, this high level of performance at every single performance, that is the challenge, because a lot of times you're only as good as your last performance. So people, if they hear a bad performance, the rumors can spread like wildfires, and before you know it, your reputation can be ruined, and they will have decided that you are on your decline and nobody's going to want you. It's very common in musical theater as well. So, you know, any business of entertainment or performance art where visually you have to look a certain way these days.
It's a hard industry.
It's a brutal industry because,
you're not nice.
You know, with the HD broadcast, we're now competing with Hollywood. So I don't think there is a competition with Hollywood, but we sort of are now. So we have to kind of look a certain way.
Have you felt any prejudice among the critics because you're Americans singing opera, or is there any anti-American bias?
No.
I think that...
Not because he's American, no.
No, I think actually because I am having a career in Europe, I think it's a huge compliment to my ability to imitate the foreign languages and be convincing with communicative skills in foreign languages, so that when I sing Italian in Italy and I'm not criticized for having an American or British accent, sometimes people think because of my name that I'm British. It's like, well, all you have to do is read the first line of my bio and you can see that I'm from the United States. But, you know, I really don't think, or if I've been criticized for my diction, if anything, I've been said, oh, my diction is not bad for a British tenor or for an American tenor, you know, something like that. So actually, I think that one of the reasons why I sing so much in Europe is because my French and my Italian are quite passable.
Well, it's beyond passable. I mean, the French is actually quite better than those French people's French. So it's more intelligible. And it, you know, singing in a foreign language isn't like speaking it. And that's a whole other, you know, conversation. But when you sing in French, it's not like speaking it at all. Yes, of course it is. You need to be intelligible, but you have all these nasalities that you have to open up when you're singing, so it actually, you know, goes beyond the orchestra. Otherwise, you'll be swallowing it, and no one's going to hear you.
And then there are also certain listeners and critics, especially in French, that are looking to hear and see if you do the guttural R, the or if you're going to roll it like the Italian R. And so, like, for instance, right now, I'm working with a conductor, Mark Minkowski, who is Polish and American parents, but grew up in France. So he grew up, you know, basically with three cultures in his life, and his preference is to roll all the R's, roll or flip all the R's. He doesn't want any guttural R's, which is unusual a lot of times from French conductors, because some people are really trying to make sure that you're really Frenchy, 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 feet.
Well,
so,
the argument on that though is, to make it clear, if you roll an R or if you put in the back R, that the way they speak, if you sing like that, you're going to be in trouble because that's, you know, on your chords. If your friend, I don't really know, I think one person I can think of, and that's Roberto Olaña, who's famous. He's probably the only one who knows how to do it safely. But most of them don't, and then they end up with vocal surgery. So, you know, the old French in theater, even when they did plays, they did not, they only rolled them because they thought it was vulgar if you did it like you spoke, because it just sounds like you're clearing your throat. So, that's my opinion, but for vocal health, all the greats have always rolled their R's, all of them, French or not French. So, you know, that's just an argument of today, and some people say we need to sing it, like, speak it, but, you know, then they don't last very long. So.
Or you can't understand them because the sound goes backwards, or, you know, a lot of people, because of the French nasalities, they end up starting to have this tongue tension or this weird placement in their face. The total goes like this, and then also that changes the way you hear the words. So since I don't have any of that, I think somehow it's incorporated in my bel canto background. My French comes out very purely and very clean, and so people understand every single syllable that I say. So.
As we watch opera, we see the different roles played by the different voices. You've got baritones, bass, tenor, soprano, mezzo-soprano, and all the rest. Are any of those roles interchangeable from the way they were written? I mean, could you as a tenor go in and play a baritone role but sing it as a tenor, or would it lose something?
Well, that's a debate.
It's a debate easily won. It would definitely lose something that was written for a certain voice type, but yes, it is done, and yes, people are doing it. Case in point, you've got Placido Domingo right now, who went from tenor to baritone, but he's also 80, so, you know, it rings like a tenor, but it doesn't have the depth of a baritone, you know. But is it bad? No. I will tell you what, we've heard it, and it's spectacular, actually, but it's not the same color, it's not that voice type. Yet, in the beginning of his career, he was accused of being a baritone, and then turned tenor. So, I mean, you'll always have somebody who says something, but if I were to turn around and sing a mezzo-soprano role, you will definitely be lacking in the color of mezzo-soprano. You'll be like, it's really bright. You want more of a darker color. And you know, the low won't be as strong because people's voices in their registers are strong.
And vice versa. So a lower voice, like a baritone trying to sing a tenor part, you'll hear them in the upper register either really struggle, or it'll get thin or tight, or they'll just struggle. And so, or they'll sing it really high, but still with that baritone color. That's very rare. Because they think, oh, if I'm going to sing a tenor role, I have to kind of sing like a tenor. So they kind of nasalize it or something. You know, try to make it somehow brighter or more forward instead of warm and rich like the normal baritone color. Just as another example on the other spectrum. So, I mean, there are also roles that are called Zwischenfach roles, which means between Fach, between voice types. And so it's usually a mezzo soprano, which literally in Italian means half a soprano.
That's not true.
But it's like
That's not true.
It's like
they have big range.
It's a vocal range between contralto and soprano. So there are some roles that are written in a certain way that through tradition and through maybe even history, certain types of voices have sung those kind of roles as well. So
really, the whole soprano, mezzo soprano, that's fairly new. In Rossini's day, there was none. It was just soprano
and alto.
Like it's not what it is today. So you know, some of those things are. Sometimes people use it for their own vocabulary, I will say. It's really, a singer is going to be where they sit most comfortably. And for some people, that they'll call it Zwischenfach, meaning like Federica von Stadt. She was one of those that sang some soprano roles and some mezzo-soprano roles. but her voice would sit high but didn't like to stay there, like to go back down. So certain roles do that, and she was phenomenal and a superstar in that, and had a glorious career. And then, you know, some people say they are and they're not, and they don't have a great career either. So you have to know your voice. And so if you know your voice and what it does, then you're going to have your career and figure it out.
The selections for your Sioux City performance, how were they selected? What was the meaning behind them?
Well, we really worked together to try to find pieces that, you know, at least some pieces that are popular enough that, you know, kind of like big hits. Yet they're big hits in the opera world. Not all of them will be big hits necessarily to people coming from the area, the tri-state area or whatever. You know, so we included some duets because we love to sing together and we wanted to have a good balance for the program. We also have some orchestral numbers that are also excerpts from operas that actually Maestro Haskins chose himself, and he ran it by us and we thought it was perfect, his ideas. So
when we were talking with John, I wanted to make sure that even if someone didn't know these pieces or know some of them that we may be introducing them to, that they'd be like, oh, that's so beautiful. Oh, that's like something I would love to hear again. Not something that would be challenging to someone's ear. Because there is music in opera that could be challenging to even a musician's ear. Be like, oh, I don't know, I'd have to really listen to that. So all these melodies are melodies that you could hum out the door.
Yeah, and we're happy to present quite a potpourri of styles and languages and Italian, French, and German. different styles and stuff that has a nice flow, but also there's enough variance that it never sounds like all the same. So we're excited to present this program, and I know that Ryan's very excited, and we'll be there in a month and a half.
That's John Osborne and Lynette Tapia, an American tenor and a Bolivian-American soprano, performing live with the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra on April 25th. Get your tickets by calling the box office now. And we'll be back with more high school basketball right here on KSCJ.